Hi, everybody. I'm Christine Dolan, and this is our Globalists in Plain Sight show. We are delighted today to have Kirk Brockovich with us, who's our partner for in publishing and also the editor-in-chief of the Balkan Dot Press, one of our online publications overseas, and Mike McCormick, the infamous Mike McCormick, who's going after the Biden family. Gentlemen, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Christine.
So, you know, there are some stories in the U.S. that become international stories. And one of them is what happened last week. It's the beginning of Hunter Biden's criminal trials. There have been, he tried to work out a plea deal a year ago, June, that collapsed when the judge in that case asked if there was an ongoing investigation and the prosecutor affirm that there was, and the judge said, well, then I can't affirm this plea agreement. So at that point in time, David Weiss became a special prosecutor and filed gun charges, three felony counts in Delaware, and then also his tax criminal counts in California. And the first trial began last Monday. Michael, you've been covering the Biden family for quite some time. You spent 15 years at the White House during different administrations as a White House stenographer who accompanied the president or the vice president overseas. But during the Biden administration, you traveled with Joe Biden on foreign trips. You wrote a book about that. Show that book. 15 years in the White House, you know, and you've written it's a case.
This is the case to impeach him, President Joe Biden. Yeah. And there's another book. I don't have it with me available, but 15 Years Deplorable at White House Memoir. And there's another one, the Joe Biden Unauthorized in the 2020 Crack Up at Democratic Party. But the latest one is this one, the case to impeach and imprison Joe Biden. And that's because I got a hold of the laptop and started digging into that. And there it's, lo and behold, so much evidence. And so that's what we
right. And the laptop surfaced mid-October 2020 when Miranda Devine wrote the first story about it in the New York Post. Then before the election, the UK Mail did a piece on it. Then Jack Macy gave the laptop to the UK guys, and they did numerous stories. And we've seen, you know, just how tawdry this internal family structure is. Now, you were in the courtroom a couple of days last week in Delaware for the gun charge case. Give the audience, Mike, a sense of what it was like, because I know you had to go up there early from, you know, from the D.C. area and get in line.
Right. I went up there on Monday. Tuesday, which was the day after they selected the jury. And I didn't go into the courtroom that day. I was just sort of scoping the place out, but also contacting old acquaintances I knew from the White House press corps who were there covering it. And that day was pretty basic testimony. Then I went back up when Hallie Biden was on the stand. That was the real emotional day.
That was Thursday, right?
That was Thursday. And I was in the courtyard, in a courtroom for that. And I was seated in a way where I could see her face as she testified, and I could see Hunter's, the back of his head. And there were, you know, I recognized some of the members of the entourage, got a hello from Fran Person, who used to be Vice President Biden's body man back in the day when I was working there. We'd worked together on a lot of trips. So, you know, he recognized me and said hello, and I said hello. It was a very emotional day for Hallie Biden, courageous of her. She admitted that it was the most shameful thing that she'd done in her life. And she's basically trying to tell the truth about it and get it behind her because she fell in with Hunter Biden. I learned this in the courtroom. This is confirmed through her testimony. 6 months after her husband, Bo Biden, died of glioblastoma, I believe it was May 30th, 2015. She was already hooking up with Hunter Biden in an affair while he was married to her sister-in-law and destroying both their families. And so that affair went on through the 2017 divorce that Hunter had from his first wife, Kathleen Buell. and destroyed that family. And Hunter by then was thoroughly into cocaine, smoking crack. By 2018, Hallie was smoking crack with him. They were videotaping themselves, smoking crack, having sex. This is just Hunter destroying himself and her, his brother's widow, the wife of his namesake nephew, Hunter. Their child, their son was named Hunter, and his niece is Natalie. And then his three children with his first wife. And the whole family was just coming apart. The only thing that held them together was Joe Biden was going to run for president. And they had to hide it all. And Ashley Biden is there waiting in the wings with her own problems. And they had to hide it all because Joe was going to run for president. And it came out in the courtroom that, you know, Hallie admitted all these tawdry things that she was doing. And the defense tried to make it sound like she didn't really know what was going on. She just, you know, didn't quite understand what Hunter was up to. He was trying to be technical. And frankly,
when you say he's wanted to be technical, you're saying the prosecutor or the defense?
Defense wanted to be technical about the elements of the law that would get Hunter off. He wanted the jury to try to understand through Hallie's testimony, his cross-examination, that she didn't know exactly where Hunter was the day she discovered this gun in his car. That's where the gun charges came from. It was actually a truck. That's where the gun charges came from. And so, you know, it was actually a very confusing back and forth with her on the stand and her and Hunter's lawyer. And so I was looking at the jury and they were just kind of struggling with what was going on. I couldn't follow it. Hallie kept being confused. The judge had to keep reminding her, this is how you have to testify about this. If you have a memory of what happened, you either do or don't have a memory of what happened. If you don't, he can use your texts that are in the laptop to refresh your memory. Do you have a memory of what happened? No, I don't. Does this refresh your memory? Yes, it does. And so that went on and on for a couple hours, and it was very confusing.
Well, so they had after the first day of the case, and they picked the jury. The second day, they actually had an FBI agent on who introduced another expert, at that point in time, they introduced the laptop as evidence.
Right, it's validated. Mm-hmm. It's validated, and that's the big sticking point for the press. Suddenly, this thing that they've been denying. And I heard some of that on Tuesday when I was up there talking to these White House press guys. They're like, yeah, we don't think that laptop is still, you know, really the story. I was like, are you kidding me? You know, I mean, they want to still cling to that notion that the laptop is Russian disinformation. It's what they have to stake their credibility on. And they're losing that stake.
Well, that also, you know, is interesting. There's a story that just broke over the weekend when Jim Clapper, who was Obama's national intelligence head, was one of the 51 people who signed the letter that came out in October of 2020 after Miranda published her first story and said that the laptop was Russian disinformation. Since that point in time, over the course of the last couple, you know, several years, even the New York Times has come out and said that, yes, this was valid. And some of the legacy media turned the tide. But it is kind of interesting when Clapper was asked just on Saturday, I think it was, if he would retract what he said in that letter. And it's stunning to me. He said, no, he would not retract it. So I guess his position is it still is Russian disinformation, even though it's been validated by Hunter, because he has filed lawsuits against John Mac Isaac, the computer guy in Delaware, and he filed a lawsuit against Garrett Ziegler, who published a lot of the laptop on Marco Polo, and it's now been identified and introduced as evidence in this case.
Yeah, and I'm in the laptop. There's a couple, you know, there's transcripts all through the laptop that I recognize when I did them and how I did them, and that's my handiwork. And there's a couple of places in the laptop where I actually mistakenly sent an email with my name at the top of the send list. Usually we're supposed to send it as a blind copy, but I just was rushing and I sent it as a not blind copy, and there's my name. So if you go to BidenLaptopEmails.com, that's Garrett Ziegler's website, and you type in my name, Mike McCormick, you come up with these two transcripts. They match exactly what I remember. So I don't see how they can say this is Russia's disinformation. I'm a witness that says everything I've seen in a laptop is spot on with what my experience was when I worked for Joe.
So let me ask you this. When Haley testified on Thursday, did you see that there was sort of a change in the mood of the people that were part of the press in the room?
I was sitting next to one guy who was there from the Financial Times. He was shocked at the sordidness of what he was hearing. He just couldn't believe it.
Where's he been for the last 3 years?
Exactly. I don't think a lot of the mainstream press would really been paying attention to what the laptop was until now. And
wow.
You know, so that was one person. And I actually gave him a copy of my book. I hope he writes about it. And he really wanted a copy of the book because I was telling him stuff about Joe Biden he hadn't heard. You know, the mainstream media kind of really covered for Joe. I frankly think this trial is a cover story for Joe. They kept him out of the story of the investigation into the laptop, and they put it about this gun event in 2018 when he wasn't in the White House. It just involved Hunter and Hallie and their texts. So all the evidence is only about those two, and the charges only about those two. She testified under immunity, so she got to say what she said without worrying about getting arrested for drug use or, you know, throwing the gun away.
Well, now on Friday, Naomi Biden, Hunter's daughter, I think she's the oldest, the one that was recently married at the White House. She testified. Now, she's an attorney. And the defense asked her about when she visited her father out in California in 2018. And she was saying that, you know, she had borrowed the car and she didn't see any paraphernalia in his truck or anything like that, which contradicts what the ex-wife said. It contradicts what the stripper who he had an affair with in 2018, and it contradicts what Haley experience when she was involved with Hunter. And in the cross-examination, the prosecutor asked her about a text that she had received from her father at 2 a.m. in the morning. I think it's shortly after he bought the gun. And he wanted to swap cars at 2 a.m. And she responded to her father, "I can't take this anymore."
Right.
And that has to be chilling. And from what everything that I have been told, when they broke at that point in time on Friday, they had a witness waiting in the wings who was not in the courtroom, but was in the courthouse. And that's Uncle Jimmy. Now, you have investigated Uncle Jimmy. Right. What's your take on Uncle Jimmy and what he would bring to the table if, in fact, he is called on Monday?
Well, you know, if he testifies for the defense, Uncle Jimmy will be to the Wilmington jurors the uncle that, you know, was Joe Biden's longtime brother, grew up in Claymont, Delaware, Wilmington guy, prominent in the community. He's the voice of reason. I wasn't an addict, but I was doing business with Hunter, and he was trying to get through rehab. They're really trying to push the idea that he was an addict, yes, but he wasn't responsible for that he was in rehab. And so at the time that he bought the gun, he was in rehab and therefore wasn't an addict. That's kind of what they're trying to convince the jurors of. I don't think it's working. And they didn't put Jimmy on the stand. We'll see if what happens Monday. I don't think it's going to be this trial is going to go much longer.
Well, you know, I thought it was very interesting you had the ladies on the stand, and then you had the ladies that were part of the Biden family, like Auntie Valerie, stepmom Jill Biden, his sister, half-sister Ashley, you know, sitting watching this play out all week. I know that there was one day when the First Lady flew to France for the state dinner with her husband, and then flew back on Friday to join this to be in the audience witnessing everything. But did you get a sense from being in the room that the jury was responding to family members sitting in the audience?
You know, the jury was a perfect cross section of Wilmington, age wise. You know, you can't tell really how people are dressed when they're for jury duty, but it just seemed like the community was there, and everybody in that community knows Joe and has known Joe and has known Joe Biden and his family, has helped their community for years and years. So frankly, I think, you know, if you're trying to get a conviction against Joe Biden there, you're going to have a tough time. Hunter may be, because of Hallie and the others, may have gotten sympathetic from Hallie. She really bared her soul on the stand, and no one else in that family is capable of that. So, and she's married. She got married last week. Her husband was there,
which I thought was a very interesting timing.
Yeah,
because that's the anniversary of her late husband's death.
Yeah, and she's still out. She goes to AA. Oh, it was the anniversary. That is weird. I didn't put that together until you said, now you said it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, very strange. It's, you know, there's a lot of strange stuff in that family. And, you know, the courtroom is, they're trying to sanitize this family as much as they can. And it's almost impossible. We know what happened in that laptop, the sword stuff there. And it's starting to spill out.
All right, Kurt, yeah. You're a publisher. How good is this story?
Well, I think it's a great story. And I think Mike's book will do exceptionally well but the story is being covered all over the world. I mean, that's the main thing. We're seeing it all over, you know, every European news outlet is covering this trial, which is, you know, in a way it's rather curious because it really isn't, you know, anything directly related to international affairs other than the Biden family is involved in it. But it is surprising. And as I think you mentioned earlier, the British press has really been taking the lead on it.
It's amazing. They ran a story today on Ashley Biden, who did not testify, but even further, you know, sexy implications from her diary about her affairs with men while she's married, while in rehab. And it's not just one guy, it's a couple of guys.
Yeah, that's shocking. I mean, it really is.
You know, I think there's an interesting observation about how the British press is invading the U.S. We have some British news executives. Now, this is not the first time this has happened. We've had Tina Brown at Vanity Fair, you know, years ago, but we have them at CNN, the New York Times, you know, Wall Street Journal, and, you know, Fleet Street in London can be a little bit in people's faces, okay? The Brits like that kind of coverage. Mm-hmm. Kurt, what do you take on that? Because now all of a sudden, there seems to be a forceful, I don't know, coverage of this trial in a way that we did not see when Miranda and the New York Post published the laptop story in October of 2020.
Oh yeah, everybody just rushed to hide it as much as they could at that time. And also in what you were mentioning, Washington Post now also is,
oh, it's true.
That's a big change. And I think you're seeing it for a couple of reasons. Well, one is the reason you're seeing more British influence in the US press coming in is because the US press has essentially failed in the mainstream media, and they're trying to look for whatever solution they can to make it, you know, to revive it. So they're bringing in, you know, the Washington Post now is taking heat because they have too many white men running the newspaper. this is the big problem they apparently have right now.
They don't have Katherine Graham and they don't have Meg Greenfield overseeing the editorial side anymore.
Exactly. And everybody's up in arms because how can we have all these white men here? This just isn't right. So that's shocking in itself. But no, I think the reason we're seeing the change is obviously because political factors, you know, have decided that they want to go after Biden for whatever reason, whether they're trying to get him out of the, you know, remove him from the ticket before the convention or at the convention, or for whatever reason, they're definitely Or then another aspect of that is, and I think you're seeing this a lot overseas, where you're having people starting to see that, you know, Trump is doing so well in the polls and everything else that they don't want to be seen as, you know, pro-Biden necessarily. They want to try to walk a more neutral line. And you're seeing that in a lot of the international media, and you're seeing it with politicians internationally who don't want to, you know, necessarily speak out as boldly on some issues as they would otherwise, because now they're afraid, well, what happens if Trump comes back into office? We have to, you know, we have to deal with him, so we can't, you know, be taking this blatant anti-Trump or anti-Republican or anti, you know, be seen anyway as being you know, pro-Biden. So I think that drives a lot of it.
Michael, when you were up there this week, did you get the sense from the conversations that you would pick up, I mean, other than the guy from the Financial Times, did you get the sense that people were thinking, wow, there's really, because I look at this as somebody who covered Biden back in the 1988 campaign. I was political director at CNN at the time. And Joe Biden never got a lot of traction in Iowa. He never got a lot of traction in New Hampshire. He was caught, you know, quoting some politicians, and he didn't give them credit. He did on some occasions, but he didn't. And then Maureen Dowd, who has a larger name today than she did back in 1988, wrote a column. And, you know, this is over 4 days, and Joe Biden dropped out of the race. And the image that we were sold in the press was that this is a guy who had a tragic beginning. His wife and child died in a car accident, and his two sons, young sons, were injured in the car accident in 1972. He used to take he's an Amtrak Joe, go back to Delaware all the time. The narrative was that he was fixed. He was set up on a blind date by his brother Frank with Jill Biden several years after his wife died, and her ex-husband has now been telling the world that no, they met in the kitchen when Joe Biden's late wife was still alive back in 1972 when he was running for the Senate and he was on one of the council. I think it was the county council. I'm not positive. It was the county council, the city council.
County council.
County council board before he got into the U.S. Senate. So we were sold a narrative. And we've been sold a narrative for years about the closeness of the family. But this is, I'm getting a feeling that this trial is shredding, nuking this tight-knit, close family. It may be tight, it may be close, but it's tawdry behind closed doors.
Yeah.
Do you see a shift with the people that you have been working with or that you've known through the years? Because I can feel it a little bit at the networks, but you know, I still see some of them thinking, well, wait a minute, you know, let's see the outcome of the case. But I don't even think you need the outcome of the case. I think the way this trial has been played out is that it rips back the curtain on the Biden family. And the question then comes up, how much will it affect the voters in 2024?
You know, I got a comment from a longtime still photographer from Reuters. I'd known him 20 years ago in the White House. He's a veteran there. I won't name him, but they think Trump's coming back. They're worried about that. He was personally worried about that. And he's not a big Trump fan. I talked to a couple of people from NBC. They are really starting to come into the realization that there's a lot more of the Joe Biden story that they have ever realized. And they're starting to try to rationalize why they didn't report it all those years. And they're not having a good, they're going to have a really tough couple of years coming out with rationalizations when the truth comes out, because it is coming out. So the press corps is still clinging to this idea that the laptop is disinformation and that, you know, Joe is still a viable candidate. And, you know, the Biden White House is clinging to that idea. And so are the Democrats. And, you know, that's what the American media is. That's why they're floundering, because they've overplayed their hand backing the Democrats for as long as they have through the Obama years. And, you know, the polls are starting to show the truth. The demonstrations in the streets are starting to show the truth. I mean, the Democratic Party is cracking up, and people see it, and they're not sure. I have Jewish friends, longtime Jewish friends, Democrats to the core. They don't know what to do with their votes right now. They don't know what to do with their donation money. They don't know what to do with their lives. So this is all part of what's kind of the pressures that are impacting the Joe Biden candidacy. And this trial is, yeah, right at the tip of the spear to get the truth out.
I remember back in 2020, I guess it was after the election, when the validation of the laptop started to rumble. And the people were asked if they had known about the laptop, if it had been validated prior to the 2020 campaign, instead of calling it disinformation, would they have voted for Joe Biden? And there was a large percentage who said that they wouldn't. But now that we have the laptop introduced as a piece of evidence, and then the gory details and admissions of the laptop, especially with Hallie Biden's testimony, which probably did not please the family. I could only imagine, if people are paying attention, what they would think about it. Because it really is kind of a shocking story. I mean, there's a number of people who, unfortunately, who have addiction problems in their family, serious ones, and sex issues, serious ones. And in most families, you know, they do not sleep with their in-laws when they're still married to their spouse. I mean, that's just kind of like, I remember in 2017, when that story broke, I had sort of a head snapping reaction to that, because Joe Biden was in the vice president of the United States and said that he and Jill give their blessing to that. And then later, when the laptop was, you know, the contents of it was revealed, it was Hunter asking his father, because his father was, quote unquote, the only one who could really, I guess, validate it and say it publicly. And then we found out later, through Kathleen Buell's testimony in her book, that her daughters found it out by looking at their father's phone, something like that. So let me ask you guys, as men, okay? To me, I found that shocking in 2017 that the vice president would acknowledge and give his blessing, because in most households, I think somebody would be thrown through the window or kicked out the door. Kurt, what are your thoughts about this?
No, I would agree with you. That would be pretty shocking, and you know where I come from anyway.
Yeah, I mean, Michael.
I don't
understand why that didn't resonate with the press corps.
I was working in the White House then. I think it came out, the Biden divorce was like April 2017. So what was happening in the White House and the press corps, Trump would come in and they were just enraged with Trump. There was anti-Trump everything, you know, the march on the women's march on Washington, all that stuff was the uproar. And the Biden thing just sort of floated underneath the surface, like a lot of what Joe Biden ever did has done. I remember seeing it. Oh, so Hunter and they're getting divorced. It didn't surprise me. And then I think when it came out that he was dating his sister-in-law, that wasn't really that shocking to me. It was kind of weird, but they're a weird family. I've always known that about Joe. That's, you know, but what really shocked me was in 2019 when he came out and publicly admitted to all this cocaine use. And that was in a New Yorker article in the summer of 2019. When he did that, I realized Joe had been lying about Hunter all these years, and everything that Joe Biden said out of his mouth was basically a lie. And that's when I started writing books about him.
Well, all right. So let's pause for a commercial break here. And on the other side of it, let's talk about the European Parliament elections that have been going on since Thursday.
Contagion Kit is something new. Can you tell us about that and what's in it and what it's for? Well, the contagion kit is specifically geared towards a respiratory virus. It mm-hmm. includes some of the medications that we've been talking about that are well known to be able to treat respiratory viruses. And mm-hmm. importantly, it includes a nebulizer, a mm-hmm. way to aerosolize a liquid medication so that you can breathe it into the lungs. Mm-hmm. Again, these kits are not meant to replace your doctor or a relationship with a doctor. They are not meant for you to fly solo. We have telemedicine visits mm-hmm. available if you have any questions about the symptoms you're having. There is a booklet in there as well that supports and kind of coaches you through what symptoms you may be having from something. So these aren't meant to be a panacea to replace mm-hmm. everything in medicine. It's a way, however, for people to feel and to be prepared, to be at the ready, to be more resilient, and to be more immune from the sorts of intrusions that we saw during COVID, where your insurance company or your own doctor or the pharmacist or the pharmacy was refusing to let people get a hold of medication.
Well, it's another day, another breaking news story, Barry. They'd rather talk about anything else than what's really going on. And it's not because they don't know what's happening. The media pundits and talking heads just don't want you paying attention. The real stories, you have to look beyond the headlines for those. We do that at CDM. You know the truth is being covered up. Prepare for what will come with My Patriot Supply. Since 2008, My Patriot Supply has helped millions of Americans get ready for the worst. Today, their best-selling three-month emergency food kits are flying off the shelves. I've seen it. Get yours right now at my website, preparewithcdm.com. This food kit offers over 2,000 calories every day, plus ultra-durable four-layer packaging. It lasts up to 25 years in storage. Order all the kits you need right now for $200 off each, free shipping included. You've been warned about what can happen. Don't live in fear. Take back of your future, because this isn't just food, it's freedom. Stock up on these food kits at preparewithcdm.com, preparewithcdm.com.
Okay, so we're back with Kurt and Mike. Let's talk about these European Parliament elections. Kurt, you cover Europe. There's 700 plus politicians up for election. Mm-hmm. It's 27 countries. The election started on Thursday. I think the Netherlands was the first one. Today, there is the final day for people to vote. In some countries, when I looked at, did some analysis of it, some countries have a little bit of, 5% uptake. I think in Hungary, it's stabilized in some others. But what are you hearing from people on the ground over there?
Well, I'm monitoring the results right now, actually, as we speak, because the results are coming in. And we're seeing a definite shift to the right in Europe. I mean, there is no doubt about it. The Freedom Party in Austria has won the election for the very first time.
Wow.
That's shocking. Shocking in the sense that it's just was unexpected by political pundits there. Mm-hmm. In Germany, we're seeing the same thing. AfD has gained second place now as the second place party in the elections after CDU, which is, allegedly center right. So the left has crashed. I mean, Scholz's party has just completely crashed. So there's shockwaves coming across Europe, and the results are not even in yet. We are seeing heavy voter turnout in France and in Hungary as well. There's some countries where it's not very high, which is like Poland isn't very, very high turnout right now.
What about Italy?
Italy is looking to be 50% turnout, which is a little bit lower than the previous election. But again, these numbers are not final.
Let's talk about what's the driving force that you're hearing. Because this is the first time, correct me if I'm wrong about this, but this is the first time in 5 years that they've had the European Parliament vote.
Yeah,
so this is the first time after, after COVID.
Yeah.
You think the COVID lockdowns, the overreach by the EU had a huge impact?
I think that had somewhat of an impact on it, but I think even more significant right now is the war in Ukraine. I think that is the driving, because I mean, the war in Ukraine is very close to these people. It's not mm-hmm. like over here where it's this thing we're talking about off in, far distant land. the European elections seem to be influenced by that. I mean, the left is, you know, claiming that, you know, any vote for, you know, what they call a far right party, which would be here, would just be a normal center right party.
Right.
But any vote for them is a vote for Putin. I mean, that's their essential mantra that they keep putting out. So I think the war in Ukraine is definitely a driving factor, along with immigration, because mm-hmm. he's been pushing these immigration policies as well. And then the COVID would be the other. Those would be, I think, the three main driving forces. And it'll vary a little bit from country to country, of course, depending on, you know, what the policies were in that particular country, or what the, you know, more of the issues that are driving the voters there. But as these results come in, we're definitely looking at, you know, shockwaves across Europe. You already have, if you look on like Twitter, for example, or something, or X as they call it now, you're seeing the left in panic. I mean, they're basically, you know, what are we going to do with the far right is, you know, gaining so much ground in mainland Europe, and they're all up in arms. So this could also bode well for, you know, for the fall here, because if you recall 2016 and the whole Brexit vote kind of, you know, was a, you know, a bellwether of what was going to come later in that year. And this may be a similar indication of that.
What happens to, you know, another factor that just comes to mind too, when we talk about the migration, there's an uptick in human trafficking right now because of the chaos that's going on. But we also have the influx of Ukrainians into European countries. Mm-hmm. And there's a cost involved because of the Schengen Agreement that was signed in the 1990s, where if you have an influx of migrations, there's an agreement that you will pick up the social cost of it. And that's not sustainable in these times. And some of those, you know, foreign leaders have come out in the past, you know, 18 months and said, this is not sustainable. The same way that we have mayors in New York and Boston and Chicago and rural areas in Wisconsin saying, this is not sustainable because the numbers are just too high. Do you think that Ursula will still be head of the EU?
I think there's a very strong chance that her days are done, because if the parliament goes to the right, you know, the European Commission depends on, you know, the support of the parliament, and that support as of this hour is in great danger, which would be certainly a wonderful thing for Europe to escape from the, you know, the tyranny of Ursula.
Well, Ursula cut too many deals with the Pfizer CEO for, I forget what the average was, but it was, and I know in Australia, it was like 10 shots for everything they ordered. And I think it was about the same number for everybody who lived in the EU as well. Michael, when you traveled with Vice President Biden, because you were on his trips during the Obama administration on the foreign trips, what was he like on the road?
You know, that's a good question. So Biden used to brag relentlessly about his foreign policy experience. But what happened was, I think a lot of people, especially in the press, overlooked it. He when he was as a senator, he always went in a group. It was always a CODEL he went overseas with. So when he was on his own, I mean, I saw him get manhandled by Vladimir Putin in Russia face to face. I mean, I wrote about it in my first book, the Joe Biden unauthorized book. And then the press always gave him a break. But the thing for Joe was, he was the second fiddle behind Barack Obama. He was desperate for attention. And from 2011 on, he really wanted to be the presidential candidate in 2016. And so he was already, he was always trying to position himself ahead of Hillary Clinton. So, you know, any press he got was amazing, and he tried to make the most of it. And so on the road in Europe, he would go to the Munich Security Conference. He would go to, you know, the NATO bloc countries and talk about NATO. And he's an Atlanticist and all this stuff. And so, I mean, they ate it up back then.
So do you think if the European Parliament, you know, by tonight, moves to the right, and all that bragging about knowing all the world leaders, you think that's going to shift? in terms of his relationships?
You know, he just came back from maybe that's why he made such a big deal about his trip to Normandy with Macron. They were sort of previewing it because I was surprised how much time and how much coverage they got over all that he did there. You know, the state dinner and stuff. That's a little more than he's usually done, especially in France. He's not a big French Francophile. So maybe that's why he was doing it, to sort of get out ahead of it. So will he shift? You know, he'll go wherever the wind blows. He'll talk out of both sides of his mouth, continue to do that. They're trying to keep Ukraine in the limelight as needing help, but they may have to start cutting deals. I mean, you know, we'll see. He's known to cut deals out of desperation, and he's pretty desperate right now.
So, Kurt, let's talk a little bit more about the Ukraine-Russian influence on these parliamentary elections, because I reported back in, I think Todd was still in Ukraine at the time, covering in 2022, and I wrote, I think it was in March, about how Macron and some other European leaders were telling me that privately, they were talking to Putin, and Putin was telling them that they wanted Joe to pick up the phone. I actually wrote a piece about this. And then the Norwegian, I forget his name, the Norwegian leader was, you know, who was buddies at times with Putin, was still talking to him then. And he went public and said that, you know, Putin made it really clear he wanted to hear from Washington. And Joe's never picked up the phone and talked to Putin.
No.
There's no negotiations. And, you know, we keep on hearing about how Zelensky wants more money and we send it. And I'm just wondering if the European Parliament moves to the right, what does that do to the Ukraine-Russian conflict?
Well, the right in Europe is dominated by parties that are anti-war, essentially. Mm-hmm. They don't want anything to do with the war. They want a negotiated settlement. You know, of course, you know, Hungary's the most notable example of that. But, you know, opposition parties throughout Europe on the right are anti-war. And if Ursula is out, you know, because she's in George Soros's pocket, and Soros, right, the money man behind the war. I mean, he's the one that's the biggest war profiteer of everyone. And also, he's the one that's calling the shots with Biden. I mean, that's clear as well, as what's going on in Washington. But no, it's definitely could be a seismic shift in European policy, but it's too early to say that for certain, because the way the European Parliament works, of course, is you have these different political groupings, you know, and they're to the right, you know, to different degrees, and to the left to different degrees. But how those groupings make alliances to come up with enough votes to create a majority, you know, that will govern, you know, and put people in the European Commission, that's where the issue comes in. So you just don't know who's going to cut what deal. But we're seeing, you know, the results are still coming in. I just saw the Netherlands, the right party won the Netherlands as well. So we're just seeing a trend starting to develop across, you know, many of these European countries. It's going to be very interesting to see what the results are in France. I haven't seen those yet, but there's the voter turnout in France is the highest they've had since 1984.
Oh, gosh. Okay. So that they're speaking up. That's interesting to me. And also historically, when I was in Europe, they a lot of times on the right, they couldn't get these coalitions to agree in Brussels, and that seemed to be a hurdle, but maybe this is a different time.
Well, it could be, although we do have to be a little bit cautious in that, because you have, you know, some of the so-called right parties, you know, which I would call more the globalist right, which are still, you know, part of the whole war machine and wanting to pursue that. So you don't know if they're going to sell out and, you know, make an alliance with the left on these issues, just like our Republicans in the House of Representatives did when they passed the Ukraine bill. I mean, they, you know, the minority of Republicans joined the majority of Democrats in order to get this done, which was, you know, itself shocking. And you could see that in Europe as well. So you just don't know right now, but the trend is definitely there. The popular opinion is definitely turning against the war and against these globalist policies. You know, like you said, the COVID policy certainly played an impact in that, and also the immigration policies, because that's a huge issue, and it's more even more so than in the United States, I think, because they're essentially trying to. I mean, the United States is a mix of people from all over the world, certainly, but these countries are ethnically based countries that have long histories and languages and specific cultures, and if you all of a sudden take a couple hundred thousand, people from the Middle East or Africa and transplant them in the middle of, Bulgaria, which is a country with about 7 million people, that's going to be that's going to make a significant impact on that society's culture and development. And eventually it's going to diminish that. I mean, they talk about the great replacement theory here, but it's a reality in Europe. I mean, you're going to lose.
And they know that from the 1990s and the migration out from the Balkans into Western European countries, because it changed the landscape of crime, and in the suburbs of Frankfurt as well as in Sweden. So people, that's a closer period of time that people say, hey, this is not such a good thing. Yeah. What are you observing in terms of the European press?
Well, the European press is, again, they're dealing country to country again, but the European press itself, what we'd call the mainstream media here is, similar to the mainstream media, in the United States, where it's really controlled by the regime that's in power and is the one that's, supporting and advocating their policies. But because you have all these alternative media outlets, across Europe as well as, in the United States, people are turning, they don't trust the mainstream media anymore. And they're getting their information from a variety of outlets of all different types. And that's, I think that's having an impact. And I think we're seeing that in these election results that are coming in.
Do you guys think that it'll be the WHO, what Biden wants to do and what some of the European leaders want to do, which is to put the health sovereignty under the WHO. Do you think that's going to be an issue? I mean, do you have any thoughts on that, Michael?
I think that's done. I'm not deep into that issue, but from what I've seen, I think they've really pushed up the awareness of the COVID vaccines is rising. The antagonism towards what Fauci did, we're seeing that in the congressional hearings. I think the WHO is a trusted source. The American public is waking up to that, not wanting it, and I think they're done.
Well, I think Mike is absolutely right, and you're seeing that in Europe too. I mean, you're just seeing this backlash against these WHO policies, and then, honestly, these things, you see it in the fact that they went so far as to attempt to assassinate the Slovak prime minister. By a radical leftist like this, because of his opposition to WHO policy, to the war in Ukraine. So you're seeing the left react violently against anyone opposing these things, which tells you that their political agenda is in jeopardy, which is why they're lashing out.
I'd be remiss not to pick up on this. The Olympics begins next month in Paris. And the Olympic Committee has come out with directives, maybe too strong of a word, but it's certainly not suggestions. It's directives of sorts to the press on the language that they can use in terms of describing. It's no longer acceptable to say a biological man, a biological woman. And I think it's just absolutely amazing that they came out with this in the last several days, because they're dictating to the press, and NBC is going to be covering it here in the US, the BBC and Eurosports will be covering it in the UK. So every, you've got all these networks for all the countries where they're going to be watching. This happens every 4 years. Everybody loves the Olympics. Okay. But at the same time, you have this organization dictating to the press on how they can best describe the athletes. And I'm thinking to myself, where's the pushback? Where's the pushback from the press basically saying, we're not going to buy into this DEI nonsense? And you know, these girls who are in sports, serious competition, and we're going to continue, we're going to really do some heavy duty reporting in the future on this. But we have girls all over the world who are now competing in regulated, whether it's, and Mike, I know you do kayaking, you know, but this is serious stuff. And I'm hearing from many of these kids that are at university level that their coaches are basically telling them, get over it. Hmm. And the psychologists are now coming out and saying, this is really bad because you're basically telling women, don't stand up for yourself. Don't be the Raleigh Gaines, you know, because right. This isn't going to change. You're going to have to get over it and live with it. And the psychiatrists who are specialists in domestic violence have now concluded that if these women are told to basically back off, that's abuse in and of itself, and that could set them up for not being able to recognize abuse in the future. So it's becoming an institutionalized pushback. What, you guys have any thoughts on that?
Well, my brother, younger brother, was in the 92 Olympics. He was a canoe racer in the Barcelona Olympics. And I had a lot of friends around the teams over the years. It was male-female thing then. I don't understand. And it should be. There should be no difference. Canoeing was one of the weird sports where the women and the men competed in the same course and could actually compare their times against each other. And, you know, I used to race against girls. It was a bad day for me when I lost the girls, but I did. Sometimes if I had a bad race, that was the reality of that sport. And it should be like that. I mean, if a woman has a really good run and she's, you know, a ski racer or a canoeist, she can beat the guys. And the guys have to, you know, admit it. And so I think this male-female stuff is just sick. My daughter plays soccer. She's going to be a rising junior in high school. She is distraught over the fact that there are boys that could take away scholarships from her friends, could keep her friends off of teams. The younger girls are getting it. The 16, 17-year-olds are suddenly waking up and going, wait a minute, we're not putting up with this.
Do you see any literature out there coming this way to stick up for the girls in competitive sports, Kirk?
I haven't seen much. I mean, the problem that you described earlier with, you know, in Europe dictating, you know, what they're going to, how they're supposed to designate things at the Olympic Games. I mean, part of that also comes into the fact that the EU, under this leftist leadership of Ursula, has imposed a heavy censorship regime and passed, you know, many laws that restrict, you know, journalists, you know, from what they, you know, things that they would refer to as hate speech, which is pretty much whatever they designate. But I mean, they would consider, you know, saying that, I mean, they could easily categorize saying, you know, biological male as some sort of, you know, pejorative term that, you know, is hate speech to.
That is, they don't call it hate speech, but they're basically saying it is definitely a corky no-no.
Yeah.
For anybody who's covering it, for any network who's covering the Olympics, you know, you have to get into the sensitivity, feel good, inclusion, don't insult anybody. And you're supposed to ask anybody, this would blew me away. You're supposed to ask, if you interview an athlete, you need to find out, you know, what their pronouns are before you begin the interview so that you don't get it wrong and insult them.
Yeah, that's this hypersensitivity that we live under these days is just.
Well, I think we're raising a bunch of Twinkies and wimps, because if they ever got hit in a war zone, they'd never survive. And yep. If they were ever were, you know, experienced the Great Depression, like, you know, some of our grandparents and parents did as kids, they would never survive. It's just that simple. I mean, I don't understand why everybody's hung up on pronouns.
Well, it's the old historical cycle, you know, that says that, you know, hard times make strong men make good times make weak men, and, you know, weak men make hard times. So it's just a circular.
All right. So we've got a couple minutes here. Anybody have any closing thoughts? Michael, you want to go first?
Sure. You know, the Joe Biden trial, we'll see. I think, frankly, the it's in Delaware, and there's a lot of Delaware backroom.
You mean the Hunter Biden trial?
The Hunter Biden trial. Well, it is kind of Joe by proxy, really. There's a lot of backroom deals. I will not be surprised if he comes out with a not guilty verdict. I will not be surprised.
Kurt, any thoughts? Give us the last reporting on European.
Well, the election results are coming in. You know, the polls are closing in a lot of countries across Europe, but it's going to take time to count the votes. But we should have, I mean, the trend is definitely established right now. So we'll just wait for the final results and see what the margins are. And then it's going to be a matter of seeing, you know, how the different groupings negotiate to form the new leadership. So that's going to be critical. And then the other thing I'd just like to mention, of course, what we can hear is the, you know, the publishing venture that CDM and History of Books have put together through Vindicta Publishing. And, you know, I'd encourage people, you know, to support independent publishing and outside of the, you know, the mainstream corporate, you know, publishing establishment, and you know, go to historyofbooks.com, HISTRIA books.com, and a lot of great books there for everyone in the family.
Absolutely. And some of my books are coming out and some of Todd's are already out. So Folks, please, you know, support us as we cover as much as we possibly can. And I just want to thank our audience for watching today. And we'll be reporting later on about the Olympics in story as well. And we'll be reporting this week on the Biden trial, kind of give you a 45,000 foot picture. Mike, are you going to be in Wilmington this week?
I'll be going back up tomorrow. I think tomorrow's going to be the final day. I think they're going to go to the jury, and jury's going to come back fast.
Yeah, I think it's going to happen very quickly. And who knows if Uncle Jimmy's going to put on the stand. I bet they rethink that. But we'll just have to wait and see what happens. So, and then Kurt, you'll put up the finality, the final numbers on
later on and on the European election results later in the day as results start to come in.
All right. Well, thank you everybody for watching us live on Globalists in Plain Sight, and we will see you next week.